So anyways, tonight we are beginning a study through the minor prophets. Minor prophets. All of you guys are like, staring at me like, what? Where are those? What is that? All right. Minor prophets. There's 12 books in the minor prophets. We're going to cover them all tonight in 20 minutes. Woo! Bring it on. Not at all. We're going to cover a couple verses tonight. Hosea. We're going to start in the book of Hosea here tonight. So turn to Hosea, right after the book of Daniel. Interestingly, these 12 books of the minor prophets are called minor prophets, not because they were less important or significant than the other writers of the Old Testament. Sometimes we think, they didn't really, you know, they were kind of like the apprentices, you know, they were the ones that were just sort of trying things out, you know, like Jeremiah and Isaiah are bringing these guys on, Hosea, Amos, you know, Joel, come and just follow us for a little bit here. Just walk with us and try it out. You know what? Just try writing some prophecies. We'll put it in a minor prophet section so that, you know, nobody's really going to expect too much from you, right? Sometimes we kind of think that way. We've got the major prophets, the minor prophets. That's not the case at all with the minor prophets. They're every bit as scriptural and authoritative as any other of the scriptures, but they're known as the minor prophets simply because of the volume of the book, simply because of the amount, in a sense, the length of their content, rather than any importance of it. It is very important, but they're called minor because of the length of their content, which is interesting because you got a book like Hosea, and then you got Zechariah down the road that's, you know, bigger than the book of Daniel. Yet Daniel's in the category of the major prophets. But anyways, that's the way it's been grouped together. And so in the book of Hosea, we're going to be seeing just some wonderful, exciting truths as we get into this. G. Campbell Morgan says, we have in the book of Hosea one of the most arresting revelations of the real nature of sin and one of the clearest interpretations of the strength of the divine love. No one can read the story of Hosea without realizing the agony of his heart. Then lift the human to the level of the infinite and know this, that sin wounds the heart of God. And so as we begin to get into this study, we're going to see a little bit more clearly kind of where and why he's writing that, where he's going with that. Hosea was a guy that had a very extensive ministry and time-wise, in comparison to a lot of the other prophets, and in fact, to most of the prophets. His ministry began at the end of a really great material and military era under the successes of Jeroboam II, the king there in Israel. And so Hosea is coming on the scene right at the end of this here when things were really becoming strong and powerful and materially blessed and all those things. But as the people are enjoying this material prosperity and political stability, it was also a time that the nation was beginning to lapse into great apostasy, you see. Oftentimes that happens, doesn't it, in a nation, as we become very comfortable, very strong, in a sense, in ourselves, that we tend to turn from the Lord. Hey, not just a nation, but our own lives. I think we can definitely see some similarities there. When things are going really well, and we're being blessed, sometimes then that we are least dependent on the Lord, looking to the Lord, and we become sidetracked with other issues and such. Well, that was the case with Israel here. And they begin to lapse into this time of real apostasy. And so this unfaithfulness led Israel into this time of great darkness and decay. Coming off this period of great political and material success, yet it leads them right into this time of very dark and a decayed time. And it's this background now that dominates Hosea's ministry. Hosea was a guy that prophesied somewhere between, just if you're taking notes, you want to write this stuff down, he prophesied somewhere between 755 B.C. to 722 B.C. We know what happened in 722 B.C. That's when the Assyrian army came in and fully defeated the northern kingdom of Israel and led them away into captivity. Now, there's no mention of that specifically in Hosea's writing, so we believe that the prophecies that he was writing down here and his message and primarily his ministry extended to just before that time happened, basically. Now, Hosea was more than just a prophet that was called to warn a nation of their sin and the impending judgment that was coming. He was a prophet that was called to live as an object lesson. All right? He was called to not just preach his message, but to live it out and experience it. Think about that here. And we're going to find out, if you haven't gone through Hosea before, and I'm sure many of you haven't, because you kind of go, that's one of the minor prophets. It's not important. I don't need to do that. So, but if you haven't gone through Hosea, we're going to get into it tonight, hopefully. Just exactly what Hosea was called to do. And it's pretty amazing, pretty heavy. But he was called to live this life as an object lesson, ultimately, of the very message that God was calling him to proclaim to the nation of Israel. And his message then would not be one that was just preached, but was experienced, you see. It's a message that wasn't just preached, it was experienced. Hosea, what would happen is, and we'll see it as we get into the first chapter, Hosea was called to go and marry an unfaithful woman. A prostitute, basically. A woman who would become a prostitute. He would encounter the pain then of being linked to an unfaithful woman. Think about that. I can't imagine having to go through anything much harder than the experience of a spouse who would cheat on me. Thankfully, I've never had to experience that. And that would be a heavy burden to bear, I would have to say. Then it would be right up there with probably any other difficulty and pain that you would have to endure. And you have to ask yourself, how would that make me feel? How would that make me feel? If you had a boyfriend, a girlfriend, or if you had a spouse that just cheated on you, how would you feel about that? You would feel, I'm sure, a wide range of emotions. You would probably fulfill the gamut of emotions there. It would be all across the board, I'm sure. One day angry, another day very sad, lonely to bitter, you know, I mean, there would just be everything that you'd be feeling. And the reason that Hosea was called to do this was, again, not only to be that illustrated sermon for the nation, but to have the experience of knowing God's heart. Think about that. What Hosea would gain from this experience and calling was that he would now enter in to this relationship with God, where he would begin to understand exactly what God himself experienced with his people, Israel. Paul talks about this fellowship of, knowing this fellowship of Christ's suffering. Philippians chapter 3 verse 10, Paul says, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection. We all want that, right? Hey Lord, let me know the power of your resurrection. But Paul goes on to say, and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed then to his death. Think about that. We all want the good. We all want the power. We all want the might. Lord, you're alive and just bring life. But how often are we to say, Lord, let me experience the fellowship of your sufferings, that I might be even conformed unto death. Whoa, that's heavy. But you see, Paul can write that knowing that there is something wonderful that takes place as we begin to experience what other people experience and go through. There's something very profound that takes place when people walk through suffering together. When people experience the same kind of torment and difficulty, there is an intimacy and a connection and a link that is fast-tracked in those situations as we walk through with one another, as we go through ourselves what other people themselves have gone through. We can go to them and say, I know what you're feeling. I know exactly what you're going through. Hey, and we just come alongside, put our arm around them, and be a help and be a support to them. There's a fellowship that is quickly brought together there in the midst of suffering. And this is what God is allowing Hosea here to experience. Hosea, I'm calling you to link yourself through marriage to an unfaithful woman. Because God's saying, this is going to be an illustration of what I myself have gone through as I called out a people to be separate and holy unto me, but they have turned away from me and followed after other gods. They've walked in idolatry, immorality. They've adulterated themselves spiritually from me. This is what God himself has experienced. And God is hurting and pained over the sin that he sees at work. And Hosea will be hurt and pained over the sin that he sees at work in his own marriage and relationship. So Hosea was given this opportunity to know God's heart on a deeper level, because he would know and experience exactly what God himself did. God called Israel to be this wife of God, called them out as that pure wife, and he brought them to out of Egypt, redeemed them, brought them to Mount Sinai to enter into a covenant relationship with them, just as you do in marriage. Things were good, started off well, but it wasn't long before it began to deteriorate, before Israel began to follow after their own lusts and desires. They walked away from God. But as Hosea was called to go after his cheating bride, so too we see God continuing to go after Israel. That's ultimately what we're going to be seeing in this book here of Hosea. What a blessing. What a great message to see woven through this here. That although Israel adulterated themselves, walked away from God, God was pursuing them. God was pursuing them, calling out to them, loving them with that everlasting love. Book of Hosea reveals some wonderful truths for us. First of all, the very name Hosea means salvation. Right? It's salvation. Same as Joshua, the Greek form Jesus, meaning salvation. God loves us and he desires to see us saved. That's why he calls us to come away from the world and from a life of sin and to walk in purity and holiness, because he knows that sin leads to death. And he wants us to be saved. He wants us to walk in purity and wholeness and in a right relationship with him for our own good. And you know what? We may mess up, but God doesn't give up on us. He is a holy God and does not tolerate sin. He wants us to be that holy and pure bride for good reason. And so those are some things that we'll be seeing through the book of Hosea. But that's all the time I have for tonight. So we'll pick it up next week. No. Doing good. I'm doing good. We got lots of time here. No, wait. Wow. We got time. Okay. Let's get into it. Verse 1 here. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Hosea, now again, he's from the northern kingdom. Remember, he's writing this, he's ministering in a time of the divided kingdoms, all right? This is when there was the 10 tribes to the north, the northern kingdom of Israel, and then the southern kingdom, known as Judah, the prominent tribe there. And so he's ministering in this time of the divided kingdoms. And Hosea is from Israel, the north, and he's writing primarily to the northern kingdoms. That's really his target audience there. Even though there were parts of his prophecies and message that were directed to Judah, it's primarily given to the northern kingdoms of Israel. But it's interesting because here in the first verse, it's mentioned, there's four kings of Judah that's mentioned, and only one king of Israel that's mentioned. Even though during the time period of Hosea's ministry, there were many kings of Israel that came and went. But he only mentions one, Jeroboam, who was reigning right at the beginning of his ministry. So he mentions four kings of Judah that were contemporaries of him during his ministry. And again, probably listing the kings of Judah because he's making a statement here and communicating that this was the true kingly line. This was the Davidic line, the line that the Messiah was to come through, the line there of Judah. And so he's mentioning these kings saying this is the true line, because remember there was a rebellion that went, and that's what happened between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And that's Jeroboam going to the north. That's why the kingdoms divided. You see, there was rebellion there. And so there stopped being a true line of kingship there in the north, but there was in the south. And so Hosea mentions that line there, primarily saying this is the true kingly line. And then it says in verse 2 and 3, when the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, here's the calling here now, okay? Catch this. Go take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry. For the land has committed great harlotry, and what that word is implying there is spiritual adultery. In that verse, the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. I mean, that would be enough to maybe experience the fellowship of suffering, just being married to a girl named Gomer. That should be enough. That would suffice to say, Lord, thank you. I've experienced the pain now. Okay. But that's not enough. God says she's going to be a woman of harlotry. Going to be a prostitute. Going to be unfaithful is what we're getting at here. Now, some have wondered and speculated and theories have been made whether or not three basic kind of interpretations or understandings here. First of all, some people wonder, well, this story here must just be an allegory, not really dealing with actual facts. Why would God have a man go and marry an immoral woman? It's got to be allegory. So some people will write off the book of Hosea that way. Some say that she was indeed a harlot when God called Hosea to go and marry. So he was saying, Hosea, here's a harlot. I want you to be united with her. Now that seems difficult to grasp because that would mean that a very moral God would be calling his people to do something very immoral and to link themselves with somebody who was that way, basically. And so there's a bit of an ethical problem then with that. And then there were those that believe what is happening here. And this is the interpretation that I would hold to, that Gomer was not unfaithful this time, that she was not a harlot at this time, that God was calling her and saying that you're to go and take yourself a wife of harlotry, knowing that this is what she would do down the road after marriage. And so this would be in keeping with the whole picture of God then also, which is what the life of Hosea was to be, an illustration, a living sermon then of what God had experienced with Israel. This would be in keeping with God selecting a people for himself, a pure people, who then later on, after entering into a covenant with God, went their own way and rebelled against him and forsook him and walked in unfaithfulness. That would be all in keeping with that. And notice also how Hosea is called to take also children of harlotry. She hasn't had children yet, but they're called children of harlotry because, again, that is what they would become, you see, a product of harlotry. So it's a future occurrence, not a present reality. So I believe, and you can draw your own conclusions there, but I believe that God is calling Hosea to a wife who is faithful and pure right now, but then would later commit adultery with Hosea. And as stated earlier, Hosea would be entering into this fellowship of suffering with God. And he would literally feel the pain that God felt over his wavering people. But the message that Hosea would be able to preach, understand this, would have such a different tone and impact to it now as well. Because there would be a different conviction to it now, a different passion resonating from his heart. Because Hosea would now be preaching that which he knew as opposed to that which he had only been told or heard, you see. He's preaching something now that he knew experientially, not just hearing theologically. And I say that to say this. I can tell you a lot of things about stuff. But it's the things that I've tried and done and experienced for myself that I'm able to speak with any kind of authority to it. And so too, the Lord may have you go through different experiences in your life and even hardships and trials and pain in your life to enable you to speak with a depth and knowledge that may not have been there before, to be able to come alongside others in support who are working through the same things. You see, I've said it time and time again. I can never grow tired of saying this, but our lives exist for God. They're His for His glory and for His purposes. And if we've truly died to self, then we're able to say, Lord, whatever you choose to do, Lord, do it so that I might just be an instrument for your purpose and glory. And so if the Lord desires to bring a difficulty in my life or a pain or a tragedy, it's so that I can learn from that. And so that I myself can be a blessing to others. Understand now that the message that Hosea was preaching to Israel, oh, there would have been a different power behind it, a different impact in it, a different passion now behind it. Because now this was not just something he'd heard about or seen, but he's experienced it personally now. And so too, I know people that have been through, oh, great hardships that, you know, I pray I don't have to go through. But I know what the Lord's been able to do through it and how they've been able to minister now to other people who have also endured that. And I've seen the Lord bring people together, the fellowship of suffering, you see. And what a blessing that is. So we see here the introduction of Hosea and Gomer. And now we see in verse 4 and 5 the introduction, and on verse 4 to 9 the introduction of the children now, the product of Hosea and Gomer. Let's look at verse 4. Then the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu, and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. It shall come to pass in that day that I'll break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So Hosea is going to have three kids that will be mentioned in this chapter, and all of them had names that had a prophetic implication and message behind it. It was a message prophetically to the nation of Israel ultimately. First up was Jezreel. It says, and this name means God sows or God scatters. God sows, God scatters. It had its implication in the nation of Israel that would soon be scattered in exile at the hands of the Assyrians who would come in and lead them into captivity. So Israel would be scattered. God will sow them, scatter the people of Israel. Jezreel was also a geographical place that King Jehu of Israel, a place where King Jehu had massacred many enemies of Israel, including King Ahab. Remember, King Ahab was married to Jezebel, who had brought a lot of corruption and wickedness into the land. So Jehu went and killed them and brought that, vengeance in a sense. Killed many prophets of Baal. That was all a good thing, but King Jehu also continued on, and he went and killed King Ahaziah of Judah, 42 of his relatives. That was not a good thing. He went beyond what the Lord was really requiring of him to do. And so here's now this word that God has given Hosea. Call your son Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu. I'll avenge the work that Jehu did in going beyond what he was really supposed to do. And interesting, because Jeroboam too, who's mentioned in the first verse, that king of Israel, this would have kind of perked up Jeroboam, because Jeroboam was of the line of Jehu. Suddenly he's hearing, what's that all about? Jezreel? God's going to scatter, he's going to avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu. Ooh, that doesn't sound too good for me here. And so it's a word also to Jeroboam too, who was not a good king, a wicked king. And that dynasty of Jehu would soon be stopped after Jeroboam. His son would come onto the throne after Jeroboam too, and only lasted a short while before he was wiped out. And that ended the line of Jehu, just as the Lord prophesied here through Hosea. And he says in verse 5, it shall come to pass in the day that I'll break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Now, a bow was a sign of power, as it was one of the chief weapons of war, of course, right? Bow and arrow, right? So to say that God would break the bow of Israel was to say that their strength and power would abruptly come to an end, that it would be diminished. And so he's saying that they're going to basically come to an end here. And So that's Jezreel. So the first child is born, Hosea, and there's prophetic implication now behind the name Jezreel. Then the second child is born, and Gomer conceived in verse 6 again and bore a daughter. Then God said to him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. Yet I will have mercy on the house of Judah, will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword or battle, by horses or horsemen. So Lo-Ruhamah now means no mercy. God is saying, Hosea, there's going to be no mercy now shown to Israel. God oftentimes would fight for Israel, right? He would be their defense. But now, he would no longer come to their aid. He would no longer come and help them. He would allow them to be carried away into captivity at the hands of the ruthless Assyrians, which nobody wished for. That was a scary proposition. And so God's saying, no mercy now any longer. But it says he'd have mercy on the house of Judah. And it's true that the southern kingdom of Judah wasn't as quick to run into idolatry and immorality as the northern kingdoms did. We know of all the kings in the northern kingdom, there was not one good king. Not one good godly king. But in the southern kingdom, there were a few good and godly kings who did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. And so that judgment was held back a little more from the nation of Judah. It didn't mean that they were a perfect great nation. It means that God would be merciful to them at this time. And again, not that they were better. We have to understand God's mercy here, don't we? Because we're seeing something here. God would show mercy to Judah, not because they deserved it. For it's not mercy if you are innocent and deserve it. Right? It's not mercy if Judah could say, well, we were shown mercy because we were a good people. Because we did what was right. No, God's saying, no. I showed mercy. You deserve this, but I didn't do that. That's mercy. Mercy is not getting what we deserve. And we've all been shown mercy, not because of what we've done. All mercy is directed to the guilty, you see. So when we look at this situation here, we can't say, well, Judah was... We can't say that they walked in a little bit more righteousness, but they weren't deserving totally of being spared like Israel was. But God showed mercy to them. And God, it says in Romans 9:15, that God will show mercy to whom he shows mercy. I thank the Lord for that. I thank the Lord for his mercy and his grace in my life. And God would do this saving and sparing all on his own. It would not be through military might or strategical means. God would do this. And we see the example of this in Isaiah chapter 37, verse 36, when God wiped out 185,000 Assyrians. Remember, when we went through Isaiah, they were encamped around Jerusalem to go and attack them. And in one night, the angel of the Lord came and wiped them out. And all of Jerusalem got up the next day, and they look over the walls, they're like, whoa, what happened to those guys? We didn't do nothing. God's saying, exactly, it's me. And he says there at the end of verse 7, I will save them. We'll save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword or battle, by horses or horsemen. It's so important, isn't it, guys, to let God fight our battles? Isn't it wonderful that we can do that? To let him fight for us? To let him be our strength, our defense, our hope, our refuge, our strong tower? God's faithful to do that. He's done that here. And then when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah in verse 8, she conceived and bore a son. Then God said, call his name Lo-Ammi, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. Lo-Ammi means not my people, just as we read there. Not my people. Some wonder if this was a child that was indeed born to Gomer in an adulterous relationship. And that this, in fact, was not Hosea's child. Not my people. We're not sure. That's speculation. So we're not sure on that. But again, the message is going forth to Israel. They're going to be scattered. He's not going to show mercy. Bathroom's right over there if you need it. Okay. He will scatter them. He will not show mercy. And now it's going one step further saying, not my people. God had every intent to be their God, didn't he? God desired to be their God, but it was because of their own rebellion that caused them to be rejected. It's not so much that God pushed them away as it is they pushed God away. And he could enforce his power and his rule and his reign upon those people if he desired to. But God will not do that upon a person's free will. He will allow you to make that choice to receive him or reject him. And that's ultimately love. To not force somebody into something, that's true love. And God's given every person every opportunity to receive him. And he's waiting and giving them opportunity to do so. But Israel rejected them. This isn't God saying, okay, you don't have a chance. This is God saying, because you've rejected me and pushed me away, now no longer my people. And it's very possible that in this name is something deeper. Like I said, that this was not even Hosea's son. Possibly a child born out of a promiscuous relationship. And again, we just simply see the pain that Hosea would be faced with. But it's again to bring that awareness that God too experiences this pain as we go flirting with and partnering with the things of the world. That breaks the heart of God. God's called us into a relationship with him. You may say, oh, you know, I only do that a little bit. I'm definitely more committed to the Lord than I am to the world. How many of you would be comfortable with a spouse speaking that way? Oh, you know what? No, I just kind of flirt and mess around just a little bit. I'm definitely more committed to you and more in love with you than I am with that person. How many of us would be okay with that? Oh, I feel so much better now. Thank you. But yet we can tend to kind of use that same sort of logic with the Lord. Oh, God, you know I love you. But yeah, I'm just having an... Sin hurts God. And it pains the heart of God to see his people going wayward. He's a jealous God, jealous for you. And again, that doesn't mean that he is jealous in the sense that he's kind of fragile or insecure. He's jealous for you, knowing that there's nothing good for you in the world and in sin. That only brings destruction. That's why God has called us to a life of holiness, because that's the path of blessing and joy in the Lord. To be separate from the world, walking in that purity and holiness. And this story in Hosea, the account of Hosea, gives us an incredible picture of what God would have had to go through and what God goes through when we turn away from him, when we go after the things of this world. We look at a guy like Hosea and go, oh, our heart goes out for him. Had to deal with a wife who would walk away from him and be unfaithful. And yet, before we jump on a person like Gomer and our heart goes out to Hosea, we have to say, does our heart go out to God in those things? Am I as grieved about that when I do the same thing? When I walk in those ways, when I do those things? Do I understand what I'm really doing to my gracious, loving Heavenly Father, who did everything to bring me into that covenant relationship with him, to be that bride, that perfect, spotless bride of Christ? I thank the Lord that, you know, there's coming a day when he will present us spotless and undefiled, the perfect bride of Christ. You know, there's great hope in all of this. And next week, when we pick it up in verse 10, we're going to see even right there just this great hope that is still there. God does not put them away. He doesn't say, you're not my people. Okay, that's it. Forget about it. He says, you're not my people right now. But there's coming a day when there will be reconciliation. Praise the Lord for that. And so we're going to pick it up next time, right in verse 10 there, and continue on.